Welcome to Signals, the podcast where we step back from the hype to look at what's shaping technology. In each episode, we talk with industry experts to surface trends, question assumptions, and unpack why things work the way they do today. We're focused not just on what's new, but on the decisions and developments that got us here and what to expect down the road. I'm your host, Michael Dowden, and with me today is Conrad Piercy. Conrad, thanks for joining me.
No, it's my pleasure, Michael. Really excited to be here. And as I was telling you before, none of the answers on my side will be AI generated today, and I am not AI generated.
Happy to hear that. We'll get only the pure unfiltered Conrad today.
Absolutely. Boom.
Nice. So tell me a little bit about what's new with you and with UX and product design. And that's a big focus area for you.
Yeah. So I've been in UX, UI, digital product design for 15 years. And I can say, the most rapid change has occurred in the last roughly, 5 years, and it's accelerating. I think things are slowing a little bit down now just because there is a bit of a plateau occurring in the AI field as far as new products coming out and the capabilities of large language models and generative models in general. But what's new with me? I launched my book late last year at the conference in Copenhagen, 90% Human, at Future Product Days. And that was a wonderful thing to get off my chest because it was a five-year journey that I'm very happy to be done with.
Well done. Books take some more time than you ever imagine.
Yes, they always, it's the editing too, that always is the surprising amount of work that you're never expecting.
So what gets you excited today to go into work and get started with something related to product design? Like what's the big thing you're excited about?
Yeah, I think what excites me a lot is working with teams who are generally trying to have all of their product divisions, meaning a combination of engineering, project management or product management, and then design come together to build unique AI integrations. Oftentimes, we've seen in the past, it really just emerging from a senior stakeholder, like let's do something with AI or engineering saying, hey, we might be able to make some cool optimizations here or use some of the new tech. But what really excites me is just seeing teams who are really trying to bring everybody together so that they're able to build systems and we could call them AI mechanics or integrations that really are able to be used and useful by all teams and every team having, some input there. And it's not just coming from one singular division of a company.
Right. So what would you say is the specific thing about the recent improvements with AI over the last 5 years that have really changed your life in a kind of a day-to-day way?
I think we often hear, at least I often hear in meetings and in conference rooms, is that we're always looking for new ways just to optimize and speed up that efficiency. And I think there's a large bet for most tech companies looking to harness AI or machine learning. There's a large bet that AI can make things faster and more optimized. And I think we're seeing now some of that pushback and that we had a lot of expectations, a lot of companies had expectations, stakeholders had expectations, and those can't always be met. And oftentimes it's a problem because the wrong expectation is brought to the table to begin with.
When you're in a hype cycle like this, sometimes you end up with expectations that either exceed reality or it just simply exceed the experience or preparedness of your teams.
The experience of the teams is definitely a major limiting factor. Yeah. Probably most of the audience who would be listening to this podcast and, reading DevMia articles and things like that, they're most likely experienced maybe more on the engineering side and they know more of the technical feasibilities of what this technology can do when you're using a model just to do recommendations or filtering, smart filtering, things like this, and smart search. But whether you're dealing with a feed or search or anything like that, oftentimes the engineers have the most knowledge on what's capable, but usually it's not always the engineers really leading where the direction of a project goes. They have a large say in that, especially, lead technical engineers there in the room sort of giving advice on, hey, yeah, this is possible, this not. But oftentimes I'm seeing, especially on the product side and definitely on the design side, is there's just a lack of information, a lack of knowledge on how these systems work at a deeper level. And you know, that doesn't go to anybody's benefit when you're building out something that may take months, or you're spending a lot of money on integration for a new model, or, you know, even potentially training your own model in-house. Is that there's a lot of, I think, opportunity now, and we're seeing a lot of it now, of just wasted effort, wasted money, because of that lack of experience and disconnect between engineering, who has been the primary knowledge holder, and product and design, who are, you know, we think we're experienced, we think we sort of know what we're doing, we want to do good, but just that lack of awareness on what's possible and, you know, what are the limitations, it starts to cause issues, as you can imagine.
Sure. So when you're deploying AI within the product design space, are you primarily trying to leverage this as kind of a back end behind the scenes concern to make the development process faster, more efficient, streamlined? Or are you trying to incorporate it into the products so that your end users are interacting with the AI in some way, or that the AI is supporting the fundamental operations of your product?
Wow, that's a big question, Michael. I'd say it's multifaceted. But what I can say, I'm going to do my best to answer your question here. What I can say is that, you know, there's a million and one ways AI can be used, and some of it's surface level, some of it you might interact with directly. And probably on the design side, that's only ever the time designers may even get involved. At least historically speaking, that's the case, is that if there's some front end interaction, the designer UX UI will get involved. But yeah, my work with teams these days, when I'm guiding teams on, as I said before, sort of bringing the different groups together inside of tech companies, product design, engineering, is witnessing the fact that it's not only when there is front end interaction happening with a model, whether it be a chat bot or again, like a feed, because you're not talking to it directly, but it's an indirect interaction with an intelligent system. And in these cases, and products should be brought in earlier for the fact that there are a lot of other things that engineers might not be focused on, whether it's user trust, how user trust translates to how many interactions, you know, a new feature might get, or a certain functionality, how that might be able to be translated to other departments in a domain. Because oftentimes, if you're spending a lot of effort, a lot of energy and money on building something that's smart, intelligent, you know, and you're using not only data power, but manpower, you want that to be used effectively and efficiently. So you want other teams to be able to understand what it's doing and how to apply it, not only within that single domain. Sorry, I think we ran a little off track here, but hopefully that answers some of the questions.
Yeah. So when you're looking at, especially from a UX perspective, one of the things we do in UX is we want to measure and understand the impact the things we're doing have on the users, right? So we're building feedback systems generally. Within the context of the AI, when the users are going to be interacting with an intelligent system, or maybe they're submitting a support ticket and they're getting immediate feedback, initial feedback from an AI, or they're we're classifying things using AI to make things easier. When the user encounters this, what metrics and measurements are you using to determine the accuracy of the output, how the users are perceiving it and engaging with it? Like, is there something different that you're doing now metric-wise than what you were doing before?
As far as metric-wise, I mean, at the end of the day, I'd probably revert back to general design standards for tracking any sort of interaction. And I don't think that changes much with AI, except that you just have maybe more variables or more complex variables. But for UX, you know, you're still looking at the unique interactions or clicks. You're looking at the success rates of that type of interaction, whether a user clicked on something the model surfaced, right? If you make a search, or if you're chatting with a model, how often does that lead to a sale? How often does that lead to a support ticket being generated versus the user sort of achieving their goal and not needing any external support? So I think from the engineering side, which is not my field of expertise, but I do know that they have their own complications there, which is they're looking at pretty much how much energy they're having to spend and how much computational power is required to provide users with the abilities that are needed for that specific AI implementation.
Yeah, that makes sense. And obviously there's a lot of ways we can try to mitigate that, but I feel like any time you're in a situation where you're trying to throw back-end resources at a problem, you've got to kind of balance the design and the implementation standpoint. So that makes sense.
And of course, engineers will know the whole pain of having clean data sets or cleaning up a data set or sort of classifying data into clusters so that the model can easily parse that information. And it's not something that necessarily I would say product or design immediately thinks about when we're in that meeting room, when we're building really cool products or we have really cool ideas of how to use AI. How to use machine learning to speed things up. Ideally, not just only take jobs, because
Right.
that's not the point here, right? We want
No,
AI to
no.
make everybody's life easier and more efficient.
That's exactly what I want out of it, is to make products better, make our lives easier, make it easier to do the things that we want to do. And I know that if you follow social media, you're seeing mixed results on that front. Is there anything that you think has been a kind of compelling part of being successful with AI heavy implementations of things? And specifically, are you seeing that the need for the teams to be really well integrated and really well aligned is even higher than it was before? Or is it simply that it's easier to notice when that's not the case today?
Yeah, two interesting questions there. One about successful AI integrations and the other on team alignment. I mean, I think they definitely go hand in hand. But
Right.
one thing we touched on earlier, and maybe it's helpful now to dig a little bit deeper on, but there really is a severe distinction between direct manipulation of an AI system, so something you talk to, versus something that understands your behavior without you directly interacting to it. And it's something I talk about in the book called discrete manipulation or discrete control. And that means any AI or machine learning system in which you're affecting its output by how long you view an image or how far you read down the page, what text items you search for, how long you watch a video or listen to a song, which songs you may listen to. All of these things, right? If we take Spotify, for example, right? Just as one consumer product, there's so many things that the user's doing that they have no idea go into the effect of the outcome of the model. And that's, I would say, part of the problem for successful AI integrations, both at an end user level, but really also at a team building level, when you're building out the infrastructure and the integration for machine learning systems, in that
Right.
understanding that there is a big difference between things you interact with directly and other things
Yeah.
that have discrete manipulation, discrete control. And all of that summarizes to getting teams, I think, aligned on a core focus of
Sure.
trust. And trust being here the cornerstone of any AI integration being successfully both with the end users or financially, maybe most importantly, or financially for a company. And the closest example I can give to you of this is, and there's numerous case studies of this online, and maybe even some of the listeners have firsthand experience of this, which is spending, a few months, 6 months, or maybe a year building something, and then users not interacting with that over the long run, or usage going down because of users just distrusting the output, or the output just not being, consistent and reliable. And again, all that leads back to, I think, the central pillar, which is much easier to understand as a team, which is trust. At the end of the day, you're building trust in an AI system's output ability, even if that's in things that you don't realize that it's giving to you, whether it's suggestions on the feed, it could be AI temperature home control. So your Nest thermostat at home, which is changing your temperature based on when you're in the house, what time of day it is, potentially even aggregate data of the neighborhood, what houses around you, what their temperature is. Like all these things can go into controlling the environment around us or the media we consume without us ever directly telling the model, hey, you know, set the temperature to 49 degrees when I'm away from home. Or, you know, I want you only to give me country music on the weekends. You know, a lot of the smartest systems we love, they do these things discreetly. And that's why we like them, because we don't have to tell the model what to do. But when that trust is eroded and users don't feel safe or don't feel confident in that system's ability to provide them what they're expecting, that AI system starts to fail. And therefore, that investment in that AI system starts to fail. So yeah, successful AI integration and team alignment, I think, involve around that discrete understanding, discrete manipulation and interaction, as well as the pillar of trust.
Right. So the trust has always been obviously a fundamental pillar of product design and implementation. We want to build trust with our users. One of the ways we do that traditionally is making sure, like you said, everything is predictable and consistent. Like if a user gives me specific input, I want to make sure that the output makes sense, is relevant to what they're trying to do, et cetera. In the context of AI-backed systems, are you finding that it is challenging to ensure that the users have a consistent experience? And are there specific techniques you're using that are being successful in ensuring that users continue to have that very predictable positive experience?
Yeah, it's a bit funny, you know, to use the word predictable when we talk about AI, because the whole reason AI often works great is that it's unpredictable. It often even, you know, it can find patterns in data that we didn't know existed. That's why I think, you know, a lot of us really love the power of AI and machine learning, is that it helps us find patterns, or helps the user find patterns and apply those patterns to supplying new information or new content, or you know, performing some ability to filter through data, which is what AI is really great at. But you know, I ran a sort of kind of a guerrilla case study one time with an older audience in their 70s, and we were looking at just how they understood the new use of large language models, because now most, you know, seniors, they've heard of and maybe even used Claude, Gemini, ChatGPT. But what I find so fun to see is that the first time seniors may interact with it on their very first experience is that they come to a realization that what they've been doing before when they search or make a request online is that, you know, if you make one request on one laptop here sitting over here and another one, another laptop sitting right next to it, if you make the same request, the same search on Google, these two laptops sitting right next to each other are going to serve you almost identical results. But when you make a query in generative models, that's the whole concept. It's generative and it is not necessarily predictable. The usefulness is in its unpredictability in a way. So you find this like really funny balance of where you want it. You want, you know, end users to have that predictable output and trust of a system, like all, you know, if you're doing deep research, to always show the links and the sources on where that information is coming from, but not necessarily always the same answer. And even, you know, with younger people like myself, when we're trying to research something and you ask them to research the same thing, they oftentimes get totally different results. And that's something we're trying to battle with, I think, in UX, which is how to handle that differentiation. But I think it might be able to be solved by itself just by the use, the prolonged use of AI, and how socially we will adapt to understanding how these systems operate. So yeah, having reliability, I think, it's something that goes beyond just, you know, showing the same results to the same person, because AI and machine learning is so dynamic inherently.
Right. Which makes perfect sense. And I totally agree with you. The types of examples that I see in the wild where the predictability can be an issue is, for example, when I'm trying to navigate using Google Maps, every once in a while, I will enter a query and it can't find my location despite where I'm trying to get to, despite the fact that's the exact same question that I've posed 100 times and have gotten to that location. So it's an interesting kind of challenge that we've created now, where there are some systems where I absolutely want the model to give me a new, fresh, totally relevant to me response. And other times I want to be able to ask you a known question and get a known answer? Is there like a balance that you've found to that kind of scenario?
No, not to that specific scenario. I think one thing that UX designers and researchers will know very well is always come back to researching your audience. Like, know your audience very well, know their capabilities, know their expectations. And if you have a significant research team or design team, they probably have these answers already on the different types of cohorts or the user groups that your product is dealing with, as well as their competency for future AI integrations. Like, how well will they be able to understand if we turn this functionality into a fully automated feature? And these tasks are being done for the user on behalf of them instead of the user having to click through manually. So I think just knowing those type of things, like who your users are at a deeper level, probably always pays off very well in the end from my experience.
And like you said, having a good multidisciplinary team that's working together, and where your teams all have kind of the ability to say, no, we're not going to do things that way, can really make a big difference in the overall quality of a product output, I imagine. That's always been true. So, looking back at how we got to this point in kind of the evolution of product design and UX, what would you say are some of the key fundamentals outside of the technology space that have gotten us where we are? And then what are some of the technologies that are really kind of leading to where you're at in the product design standpoint?
Interesting question. So past technologies and future technologies, where that's taking us.
Yeah, exactly.
On the design, I can only really speak confidently and competently on the design side, but on the design side, designers have a lot of tried and true mechanics for understanding if a tool or if a new feature is working, how well it's working. And that's through user research, user testing, usability testing. But I would say on the newer front, there's a lot of interesting research papers that are gaining traction, even that are quite old, because we're seeing its applicability still today. And some of these things, for instance, are these old metric testing acronyms, which are, you asked me earlier before, like, how can we test to make sure things are running well? Well, on the engineering side and the research side, they've had these for quite some time. And I think reapplying those today is still very useful. And two, for instance, I'll list here are one is called the ABI Plus model. It's an acronym that stands for ability, benevolence, and integrity. Predictability is also usually attached to the end of that. So ABI, that's why the little plus. And there are little ways of testing for these, which I won't go into detail on this call, but I'm sure if the viewers are interested, they can look up that model, that ABI Plus model. And these are ways of understanding, the effectiveness of an AI integration of a machine learning model. There's also the FEES framework, FEAS, all these fun acronyms I'm going to be throwing at you, so be ready.
Always.
The FEES framework it breaks trustworthiness down into four essential pillars. So we talked about trustworthiness, and again, back to your question on, are there anything, new tools or frameworks I think that are helping teams? Well, this is definitely one of them. And it breaks down trustworthiness into four essential pillars: fairness, so no biased outcomes or favoritism; explainability, clear reasoning behind decisions; auditability, which is transparent accountability; and of course, safety, so no rogue behavior or unintended harm. And in AI UX design, these principles ensure that systems feel not just efficient, but ethical, or for our context, user aligned, that these systems are user aligned. Because one of the really, I think, tricky parts about all AI, and this is all AI and ML, and it will continue to be a problem for the next 25 years, as far as anybody can see into the future, which is that it's almost impossible to have a solution for ethics or alignment to user needs and goals. And why is that? Why is, like, ethics such a big, hard problem to solve, or user alignment? Well, that's because ethics is heavily tied to the dependency of the person you're dealing with. And my goals, my ethics, my behavior is determined by my own personal being. So that could be very different to many other people around me. Take, any hot topic today, whether like political topic, even whether that's abortion or creating like a more standard drug legislation, more open drug legislation. Take, for instance, free speech. You know, if you ask somebody in a relatively conservative Arabic country, their answers might be heavily different from a predominantly Nordic society in Northern Europe. I like to use the general idea of understanding why ethics is so hard, and understanding ethics and like user alignment is make a little circle around yourself, like hold your arms out. And while you're holding your arms out, imagine like, okay, this is my circle of understanding of who I am and what I believe in. Like, for instance, stealing is bad. Cheating on your taxes is bad. How far do you have to open up your arms and enlarge that circle around you till you start to include somebody who has divergent views from you?
Right.
Now, you probably don't have to go that far till, because the world is just so globalized at this point. You don't have to go that far, you know, even outside your own neighborhood or your own building, to find somebody who has divergent views with you. Yet most AI models and machine learning models are aligned with central viewpoints, like central ideas and themes on ethics or user alignment. And that's why we see a lot of things in the news where AI models doing something that we don't want them to do, well, or acting in an inappropriate way. Well, that's inappropriate to who? And that's why it's, you know, it's so hard to create a model that's aligned individually to everybody without upsetting somebody. And of course, a lot of the biggest models and most powerful AI integrations, intelligent systems we see integrated, they do have some basic bias built into them. It's impossible to create an intelligent system without bias. So what do we do? How do we, you know, start creating fair systems that are explainable, that are safe? Well, you have to start first admitting as a team, as a whole, each one of us and many of our users are going to have different alignments to what we think is correct or safe or fair.
Right.
The only true way, and this is, look, I have to be honest with you, Michael, this is my personal hypothesis and what I write about in the book, but what I also teach teams on. And it seems to be, you know, for the most part, it seems to be agreed on, which is that the only way to solve for this major issue is to allow the users to have clarity on how their actions affect the machine. And that leads into a point that you, I think, brought up before, which is transparency.
Yep. From my perspective, a lot of the things you've talked about, they've been fundamental to design for a long time. One of the biggest changes that I see with more automation, and specifically with the AI systems, is that if we're not having those conversations, if we're not doing this alignment, if we don't have good systems of measurement and automation in place, it makes it almost impossible to deal with the dynamic nature of an AI system. Whereas we kind of maybe could have gotten by before. Like it's almost like when you automate, when you scale up, when you add AI, you've added this component of speed and unpredictability that really shines a spotlight on the weaknesses in your teams, I would imagine, and in your processes.
That's what makes AI so great, but also so terrible at the same time, is its speed and efficiency. I mean, never before in human history have we had these types of computationally intelligent systems. It's not like films like iRobot or something, or Ex Machina. you know, they're not totally sentient. You know, in many ways, agents are capable of performing actions on their own, and behind those actions are intent and bias, and they're things that we cannot undo. For an AI system to be smart, for it to leverage the information it needs to leverage and then perform its actions, its duties, whatever that may be, it needs to have some sort of understanding of the world and its data. And by training the model, you give it that inherent bias. So I think, you know, exactly what you talked about, that the speed and unpredictability of it really throws a lot of potential, like well-meaning solutions or solutions that we've used in the past for, you know, software development. We have to throw that out the window. We really have to start from scratch. And I think for senior stakeholders who are oftentimes sort of pulling the levers of product development, who aren't really necessarily, they're not deep in the code, they're not deep in the user research, they need a lot of convincing on how to set fair barriers so that you don't create something that you sort of lose control of, or, you know, you end up offending a lot of users or giving them the wrong information.
Right. So if somebody is not yet heavily utilizing AI within their product design, what would you recommend as like a starting point for kind of jumping into more of a modern approach to this?
I would actually quote one of my other good friends, and she wrote a book on AI as well, and it's specifically related to AI and business. We can bring up her name in the interview, but first name, Yana. She wrote a book, and it's interesting to see her also speak on stage, because she often cites that the number one problem she sees in teams, and I see a bit of parallel in this as well in my consultation, is that teams are often coming to the table because stakeholders have told them to use AI to automate something. And so, or they just want to use AI in general. And they're not solving a specific problem with AI or trying to clean it up using machine learning or make things more efficient with machine learning. But they just want to use machine learning AI in general without any specific purpose, without solving a specific goal. And a lot of engineers, I think, know this problem as well, which is that you don't always need machine learning or AI or LLMs to make something better, more fast and more efficient. There's often other mechanics for that. And so oftentimes, if you could be putting the wrong resources, time and effort into building something that's quote unquote AI when you don't really need that.
Yeah, 100% agree. The litmus test that my teams use, is there a cheap, easy, efficient way to solve this problem without using AI? Great, let's use that. Is this something that is too expensive or too challenging or too hard to solve without AI? Perfect, then let's tackle that challenge. It, to me at least, this is an important tool, and it's a tool that we can leverage behind the scenes to help us build the product. It's something that we can leverage by putting it into the products. I've had machine learning solutions built into products for over a decade now, because they can do things that would be otherwise impossible to scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's interesting and unique right now is that I'm seeing conversations, especially like you kind of touched on the business space a little bit, but in both business and product spaces, where I'm seeing some people advocating that, well, it's not really a tool, it's more of an employee or a worker or all these different ways of looking at it. As an engineer and with a little bit of a UX background, I definitely have always, this is a tool to use when it makes sense and to maybe do other things when it makes sense to do that. Where's your kind of balance on that, or how do you find yourself talking about the integration of machine learning and AI into the systems? As a tool or something else, or?
Yeah, I'm pondering your question. maybe if you could just repeat it one more time back to me, because I'd like to give you a clear answer.
Yeah, sure. So I'm seeing different terminology and different approaches to how the conversation around AI takes place as we're integrating into products and into teams and businesses. And so I'm seeing some business folks advocating, hey, stop calling AI a tool. It's really more than that. We're implementing it as workers or as employees or as whatever. So don't call it a tool. It's really more than that. And I'm seeing other people, like, I still very much think of it as one of the tools in my toolbox that I might use. Where's kind of your balance on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, not every team needs to use AI. I think every team should consider, you know,
sure,
some sort of intelligent system integration. And, you know, we're just using that umbrella term AI here to mean sort of any intelligent system, machine learning, large language model, any generative stuff. But yeah, I would say, you know, it's worth considering. Every team probably is worth considering some sort of use for it, even if it's just, you know, creating an internal AI tool to help decode your FAQ for employees to make it easier to figure out, you know, how to submit tickets to HR, you know, whatever, maybe. It might not even be an external thing for the use of your end users. I would say that there's probably some place for it to be useful, but it doesn't require necessarily building something of your own.
Right.
Right. There's a lot of resources out there now a lot of startups creating small tools that can be easily sort of dropped into existing frameworks, codes, and databases that prevent you from having to spend a lot of time building out your own thing. Of course, at the end of the day, it all comes down to like clean, usable data, which is probably the number one thing I see most teams struggling with just to get started, is like, other than defining a clear problem, like, oh, we want to solve this specific problem with AI. That's why we're going to try to attempt to do it using AI capabilities. But the first hurdle they bump into, other than seeing like, oh, we might not need to use AI for it, is like, if they do want to use some intelligent system, their data just isn't prepared to handle the parsing of that data, or it's just not readable, or easily categorized already to be used by a system, intelligent system.
Sure. So are you finding that there are specific cases where you're like, yeah, this is maybe not a great use case for AI, or is it not that clear cut?
No, I don't think it's quite that clear cut. You know, I have some really fun stories of a lot of different companies I've worked with. The one that always pops into my head is a team in Berlin, Germany, that was, to keep me out of hot water, I won't mention any company names, but it was a very large company dealing with auto sales. And that auto seller that sell globally, but primarily also in Germany, they were hoping to integrate AI as a sort of customer assistant tool to help users find the car they're looking for. You know, your car is too old, you're trying to buy a new car or a slight gently used car. And so, you know, you need a new car, but you don't know what you need exactly. And so if you're just not a car person, you're like, oh, I need something with four doors. I need it to be white. I want it like low maintenance, this many miles, you know, safe for kids. And they tried to create something like this. But one of the first things, obviously, in my conversations with the engineers, as coming from the design side, trying to bridge the gap between product and engineering, I often find myself in that position as being somehow the translator, which I never signed up for that originally. But I'm in that position here often. And it is fun to help people sort of understand the boundaries of each department. But in this specific use case, the lead project manager, you know, we were sort of entangled into how to launch this or when to launch it. And some of us were advocating for like, hey, this isn't really ready for public trials yet, or even a full launch, maybe like a really small soft launch beta test, but nothing more than that. And one of the arguments, you know, I saw there was, why are we so afraid of this? Like, we know this tool, we know it's not perfect, but we just need to get some initial data. And that's often like a first excuse used, like we need some initial data. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fair point when launching an early AI system, like AI enabled system. But one of the major misalignments was a understanding from product. And I think that I have an assumption that that was also to a higher level with the senior executive board as well, which was that this tool we were launching, which was feeding back answers to users as they were submitting prompts looking for their car, is that there were major stakeholders that were under the strong assumption that we knew where the answers were coming from. And of course, like most companies integrating external models or using, you know, something that they can just sort of dump in with their data, dump in with their website, and just launch it without much work, is that even if you're coding your own model and you know the data, you still don't know where all the information comes from, unless it's a heavily siphoned and filtered model for responses, in which case it might not even be that helpful, right?
Right.
The models that are a bit more flexible and accessing more data with less restrictions, less parameters, can be more creative sometimes and can potentially solve more of the user queries when we're talking about a generative prompting model where it's conversational. And that central idea, you know, I don't think it's unique to that team that I was dealing with, but there is, you know, even that fundamental misconception, like we know where the answers are coming from. They're coming from this model, this external model that we're tapping into and using. But when you ask them like, oh, but where are those answers coming from? They don't know, because even the team behind that model doesn't really know. It's always a bit shocking and a bit scary that, you know, people building our current products today that many of us use, you know, that hundreds of thousands of people are using, and, you know, new integrations are popping into many of the services we use today, that these kind of misconceptions are still happening in very intelligent product teams. Because the company I was dealing with was very intelligent. They had very smart employees, But that sort of misconception of like, we know where the answers are coming from, but we don't. And therefore, we can't protect the users from accidental like messages, inflammatory messages, or unsafe messages about this car is safe or has a 5-star safety rating when it might not, because we don't know where it's parsing that information or pulling that from. Those are the kind of things, you know, I'm fearful about when we're looking at AI being integrated as a tool or yeah. I might have derailed there a bit. Sorry.
No,
You got to keep me on track here,
no.
Michael.
Oh, no,
I'm willing to go off the deep end.
that, but that's super interesting, right? A real type of case study like that is very illustrative of some of the things you may run into as challenges. So one of the things you'd brought up to me earlier is something around content manipulation. So is this when you're in this unpredictable model situation, you both have the unpredictability of how do I make sure that the model isn't going to tell the person something that is untrue, but also because we can't trace back to exactly where everything's coming from, does that open us up to a whole new avenue of the content and information can be manipulated in a way that we can't predict and control?
Manipulation, you know, it's a big word, and I don't want our listeners or my readers to think that manipulation is a bad thing. You know, manipulation as a general word is just to, you know, to manipulate an object or a person, place, or thing, and it can be oftentimes in a good way. It's not only with this negative context. So let's just set that sort of in the stone as a foundation. And I would say first and foremost, for anybody looking to work with their stakeholders, make sure it's known that we can't prevent that. You know, we can't prevent it from saying the wrong thing. We can't prevent it from making inflammatory or racist slurs. Something might pop out by accident. There's always that chance, unless you have a really tight model and it's really heavily controlled. There's always that small chance of you getting something wrong for a specific user or a bug or the model sort of going off track. The more you train, the more parameters you set in, like the more you can maybe wrangle it under control. But still, especially when dealing with generative things, and if it's not built in-house, if you're tapping into an API, you don't always have the level of control you're going to want. And so I think all stakeholders should go into it with a really sort of bland stomach, open eyes, like there's going to be issues in the future. So not like how do we prevent it, but how do we put on the bandage after the problem occurs? Because it will occur eventually. And as it relates to manipulation, which was, I think, the second part of your question there is this discrete level of manipulation, which we talked about before. And I think that's the most worrisome. That's what we have to worry about the most. Because if you're talking to a model and it's telling you things and it's conversing to you in an anthropomorphic way, as another human would, you can sort of see how it might be manipulating you with its language it's using, with what it's saying. You know, now not everybody might be able to read through the lines, especially if you're not well versed in using these conversational models. But machine learning is used much more discreetly than it is just with these heavily direct interaction models like the chatbots. There's many more machine learning models that I would argue are much more useful, much more effective, that are behind the scenes, right? That's what gives us the sort of the news we're looking for, or even the one that puts us in the, you know, the echo chamber. That's the one that gives me my Spotify music suggestions that I love every week. That's the one that filters all the spam out of my inbox. These things, you know, we wouldn't want to go back to a world without them because they're just so useful.
For sure.
But these are those discrete systems that when they manipulate, the effects are much worse. They are much worse than direct manipulation systems where, or direct interaction systems, the chatbots we're used to, Claude, Gemini, GPT, these things. And it's because they're discrete and we don't directly control them. We don't know the control levers. The users don't, at least. The engineers, you know, the teams behind it might. And I would hope that on the design side, more designers get interested in this topic to know what levers are controlling the system. That's one of the first things that I instruct design teams on, product teams on, are to learn what those levers are. Once you're able to understand that, trying to bridge that transparency onto the user side. Now, that's not as easy as it sounds, of course, because you're dealing with both two things: technical complexity of how these systems work And then as well, the business side, which is you're protecting a certain level of IP and you don't want necessarily the users or competitors to know how the system is working or what data you're leveraging. And so really it becomes this crazy balancing act of how to give transparency to users so that they understand how they're manipulating that AI system and also how that AI system might be manipulating them. Yeah, even slightly, even just in a small way. So maybe as you're searching for cars, it's manipulated you into thinking you really need a larger car than is necessary. You might never notice that because it's so subtle in the way it's serving results or suggesting you things. Even when you're looking at like comments in YouTube or comments in other services that have, you know, user comments and an interaction feed there, is that certain comments are pushed to the top of that comment list for certain users, not for everybody. Sure. And so even what we see is filtered through a specific lens on what that system thinks we might engage with more or what we want to see. But we don't know what that system knows about us or what we've done to that system to affect its output. And that is the crazy part. So how do we create transparency that's both good for the user, it's safe for the business, and it's technically possible, right? Like we can actually do this reliably from the technical side, is in explaining something on a basic level that a non-technical user could grasp. And that's that finesse part that probably takes the most time to build and to understand and to get right.
One of the things that's interesting about what you just pointed out is it's not even this sort of subtle guiding and manipulating of results can happen regardless of the technical system we've implemented. So using the automotive example, you can get pushed into buying a slightly larger and larger vehicle over time simply by the product design team building and designing the vehicles, putting specific key features only in larger vehicles. So if there's a feature that you need, but it's only available in a slightly larger vehicle, that can skew you to buying a slightly larger vehicle than you might have otherwise done, regardless of what those search results or the actual data getting you there, right? It's because that's what's actually available. One of the great examples of this is automakers love to point out, well, people primarily buy black and white vehicles, maybe some gray. That's what the stats show. Well, that's because that's all that's available to purchase, right?
So it's the market the market effect.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen this example before in UX space. I've had teams tell me, well, nobody uses our product in mobile, so we can focus on desktop only. And I'm like, how do you know that? Well, the data shows that. And they'll show me all their analytics. I'm like, amazing. That's exactly what the data shows. You know why the data shows that? It's because your application is 100% unusable on mobile. So nobody can accomplish any tasks on mobile. Therefore, nobody uses it on mobile. Therefore, the data now shows you that nobody's using it on mobile and you have created your own cycle. You've created your own data set that you're now using to drive product decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the environment that you work in often can determine the output and the usefulness of certain features and functionality. And so,
for sure.
Yeah, I like that example you gave of if the site is unusable on mobile or, you know, if one segment of your device types are just lacking, then it's going to skew all of the rest of your informed decisions.
Absolutely. So when we look forward now, what would you say is the next big thing to come in product design and UX? Like, what are you looking forward to?
First, I would definitely suggest again, my friend Jana Limbinkova, and she's got a book called The Art of AI Product Development that just launched. She's into really cool stuff. She's a PhD in AI, also in Germany and Berlin. And, you know, that's without hyping also my own book, 90% Human, I also have to hype hers up as well. It's a great book.
Love it.
I would suggest readers to pick up one of those books, 90% Human or the AI Product Development, and try to have non-technical people get educated in the space and the risks of AI and machine learning development, because still, you know, as much as I think digital teams are learning about these new technologies and what's capable and what's not, there's still a huge gap in awareness on how the different teams cooperate with one another. Even just when product or design would come into starting to scope out a feature is still way too late, usually in the design development cycle. And so it gets me excited to know that this is something, that's not unique to my research and my book, but other people have realized this. It's something I think teams are striving to do, though it's a slow moving train. And we just need to give that train a little more fuel. I hope with the advice I give to teams that I train or companies that I advise, that that's taken to heart, and they really start to look at not just how can we integrate AI, how can we automate, but what problem are we trying to solve, and how can we create transparent systems so that users are happy and content, and they're using your product with a smile on their face that at the end of the day doesn't manipulate them. Because as soon as an errors, in these AI systems can happen just at the snap of a finger without you ever really planning for it, without you ever expecting it. I think really the only way for that is creating that trust and transparency loop with the user. But again, as we said, right, that's a crazy balancing act, and it requires some guidance from people who know the field and sort of can bring teams together on those topic areas.
Nice. I love it. So, where can our listeners reach out or follow you or get connected with you?
Yeah, so you can reach out to me on LinkedIn, even though I'm definitely trying to slow down my use of that service. I think anybody who's seen LinkedIn over the last few years, your like notifications feed is no longer relevant at all to you anymore. It's just, it's spam. Your notifications bar or your notifications list is just spam, which is sad. They could use some machine learning, actually. LinkedIn, this is a little nod to you. But you can also look me up. My name, Conrad Piercy. Online, I have a website, conradpiercy.com, and /90%, spelled out 90%. And there you can read about my book. I have a bunch of articles online and stuff like that. Or you can just, go ahead and order your team a dozen books on Amazon, or contact me. I also do bulk orders and team trainings. But yeah,
Fantastic.
it's been wonderful chatting with you, Michael. This is I'm always happy to speak with the team at Devmio and Sans.
Nice. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been fantastic. Like, this is a great conversation.
Well, I hope to be back
Really
soon
appreciate
again.
it. Awesome. Thank you so much.